Welcome to the Biopharma Dispatch podcast. This is the last podcast for 2021, and we've made a really deliberate decision that we're going to commit our final publication for the year to the patient experience. I am delighted to be joined by Nicole Cooper, who of course is a patient and we've spoken to before, but she's obviously much more than that. And Nicole runs her own business, Convalis Consulting, and she's also become a very powerful advocate for change based significantly on her own experience. And we're going to have a bit of a conversation about that today, wrap up the year and look ahead to next year. Nicole, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me again, Paul. Such a pleasure to be here.
Now, this is not an insignificant week for you. Your Christmas celebration is going to be a bit different to other people. Maybe you could just talk us through what your week looks like.
Yeah, well, today, I mean, Monday is always a bit of a whirlwind for everyone, isn't it? Kicking off a Monday. But for me, Monday on a fortnightly basis is always preparing for chemo. So Tuesday to Thursday of the lead up to Christmas will be chemotherapy for me, which we do on the ward just to manage my side effects. So yes, today is the last hurrah of things I might like to do before chemo, which, you know, is a limited list given I've had my COVID test and will now go into isolation until I can get to the hospital ward. So yep, bring on the last chemo and then bring on Christmas. That's where I'm at.
Yeah, we often talk about patients and we often talk about the patient experience, but it strikes me that often we don't actually include patients in that discussion. That the patient as an external, as a stakeholder in decision making, right? But obviously patients aren't stakeholders. They are the people for whom the system is intended to serve, I think. You know, how have you found engaging with the system, so called?
I think overwhelmingly my experience has been so positive, and I have been, you know, welcomed with open arms, I guess, because I always found it natural to want to share my patient experience. I just felt, I don't know, maybe I'm just comfortable talking about it. I don't see sort of a degree of privacy or, you know, personal journey attached to that, insofar as I don't want to share it with other people. I just always felt like it was a sort of a natural, it's just a part of my life, I guess, all encompassing part of my life. And so, but I guess the response from people, be that policy and bureaucracy or people in industry or people in health administration, have sort of said, wow, the fact that you're prepared to share so openly is a bit of a game changer and really exciting. And I don't know, I found that interesting as an observation, but my wanting to change things, improve things is just, I think as I've acknowledged before, sort of driven by my personal experience, yes, but then my professional experience in being a change manager and working in performance improvement and just spotting opportunities to improve things naturally. That's just kind of the way I've always been. So overwhelmingly, I'm welcomed with open arms as a patient. Yes, let's get that patient in. But then I find the execution of that idea to be a very interesting experience and so variable depending on who I'm talking to. But this common experience, as you say, that wanting to include a patient and embed the personalized nature of a health journey is one thing, but the execution of that is quite another. And it's an interesting experience for me because I'm living this as a very personal journey, and I'm very acutely aware that in healthcare, the future of patient treatment is personalized, right? That's where we know we have to be. We have to be bespoke. We have to be made to measure. And yet the system as a whole is really designed and executed for the extreme opposite of the personalized experience. And depersonalization is really, at times, feels like the intent and the plan of the system. So it's the balance of those two things and trying to achieve that, trying to actually find space for a patient's voice and opinion and participation, that's difficult, I think. But the intent is positive.
It's really interesting you say that. I spoke to Richard Chu, who's the head of Novartis in Australia, late last week, and he said a very similar thing. He said his experience is that everyone is well-intentioned and that there's a great commitment to collaboration, but the system just isn't designed to deal with the sort of technologies that are coming out of company pipelines these days. So that good intention and that commitment to collaboration come up against an institutionalized problem that needs to be overcome. And that seems to be what you're describing as well.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that when we're in this, I guess the flavour of the system for many of its participants at the moment is a flavour of review and a flavour of improvement. And, you know, we've got a lot of reviews and improvement opportunities and intentions that are kind of coming up at the moment. But I think that the theme that's resonating for me quite consistently is the intent to review a system is always good. That's always going to be a positive thing, right? We've got the national medicine policy, it's up for review. We're having a conversation about that. Of course, that has to be a positive thing, that we're looking at it and we're doing something about it. And we're recognising a need for improvement. But that intent only goes to a point. And then at a certain point, we have to say, okay, well, what are we doing with that opportunity? And what are we doing with that review? And something that is really sort of striking me again and again in conversations with people is that the goal of medicine is not relative, it is absolute. And so when we're having conversations about look at our system in relation or up against to or in comparison to all of the other systems that are out there, I don't think that's an appropriate characterization of the goal of what we should be trying to achieve here. Just because there are examples out there of other systems not doing so well doesn't mean that we should be happy and proud of what we've got here. The goal of medicine is absolute. We either make people better or we don't. We either give people access or we don't. We either live longer or we don't. That means that we have to improve it in absolute terms, I guess. And that's something that I am trying to, I guess, characterize more from my experience, is that incremental improvements and relative improvements are good for some industries in some cases. But when you're talking about human lives, and when we're talking about the impact of getting a decision in medicine right or wrong, we're talking about absolute terms, and I think we need to maybe pivot our understanding of that slightly.
Seems to me that we sort of talk around the issue a lot. So yeah. We have reviews and we have the parliamentary inquiry and we have all of these processes, but, and maybe this is a point of personal frustration, no one just calls it. And because if we are, If there is a need for so many reviews and inquiries and processes, and obviously something's not right. I mean, you should obviously always review things, but when you've got three reviews going on at once, it's just something's not quite right. But there seems to be a reluctance to just come out and just say it, that we need to do better, and let's all agree that we can do better. Now I understand that politically, it's hard to do that, but I don't think constructing a system for the future based on technological innovation is in any way an admission of fault or problem. I think it's just doing the sensible thing, but there just seems to be this incredible reluctance to do that.
Yes, but I think that it's such an interesting point, isn't it? Because we are so open and willing to acknowledge that the cutting edge of research or investment in medicine at the moment, it would absolutely argue, it could not argue anything other than the future of medicine is personalized. That we have to evolve our thinking and our investment and our attitudes, personalizing medicine. And that's an enormous step forward. It's a big cultural step forward. It's a step forward in so many respects. And instead of sort of acknowledging that evolution, getting on board with the innovation required and the decision-making required to pursue that line of thinking, that there is, as you say, that sort of tendency to, well, if we admit that technology is changing and progress is a thing and personalized is the way to go, then somehow we're undercutting ourselves, our achievements, our commitments to date. And I don't think that that is so. And I think that it's so important to characterize it as personalized and that the system needs to support that. And I think that future of medicine being personalized, that debate has been done been won. We know that. You know, we've done this. And so if that's where we, that's where we're going, and really that's where we are now, then there is nothing lost in admitting that that the system can't support that and now needs to join in that process of evolution.
It's funny, isn't it? I was caught up with someone yesterday, and we were jokingly making the list of the top 10 ridiculous things in decision making, and we went well beyond 10. And one of the sort of a podium finish is definitely this sort of reluctance to admit that the system will need to be reformed and changed in order to accommodate technologies. And I think you said it. I think Richard from Novartis said it late last week. He said, look, everyone seems to acknowledge and want to work together and get the best outcomes and get faster access. But the first thing we need to do is admit that we're not quite there yet. And then everything else will follow. And I think we see this with the National Medicines Policy Review, where the idea of a overarching vision statement for medicines access or medicines policy in Australia is somehow contentious. And I don't know whether to laugh or cry, to be honest, when I hear those sorts of things.
Yeah, and it's so disappointing that that's the kind of conversation that we have to have, you know, when you think that the people that we have in the room, so to speak, who are able to drive change and reform in this area of our lives, it's so significant, it's so important. We've got the biggest, brightest brains in the room on this issue, and we're debating whether or not we need a vision. I mean, come on. it's that part of things is exhausting as a patient, because every day I see the real impact of not having a defined vision, of not saying, no, the access is what we need and we will pursue that. We will go after that. That is our responsibility. And instead having these, yes, but we do have to weigh up, and we do have to consider that kind of yeah, but attitude is cultural. And when you set that from the top, it has to flow through the system. And I think that this is what is often missed, is that when we have a yeah, but and a kind of approach to healthcare, that flows through at the pointy end of the system, right? That is experienced by a patient day to day. And when we're talking about can we do something, or is there access, or is there an opportunity for treatment here, that attitude of, well, yeah, there could be, but there is also the consideration of cost, and there is also the consideration that, I don't know, statistically speaking in your age group, this is probably not going to happen, or statistically speaking. And we get very comfortable with writing things off to statistical models that have done that have been there in the past, or numbers that we've crunched that have made us comfortable with the economics previously. And that becomes the kind of overriding sentiment at the pointy end for the patient. And the overriding sentiment at the pointy end for the patient should be, what's the single best treatment avenue, care opportunity for you, and how do we make sure you've got that, and why don't you already have it, and why aren't we already in that? And that's what makes me so frustrated, is that if we could just characterize the vision as access or outcome or whatever it is that we want to characterize it as, we just need to do that. We need to get on with that. That should have been done. Let's do it. And let's see then the benefit of having done it flow through to the system participants, who actually then can realize what's important and can then make their own decisions accordingly.
I think one of the reasons you're such a powerful advocate is because you do have that background in change. And so what you do is you pick up, you've in all of these conversations about reform, you pick up all the barriers, the subtle ways people put hurdles in the way of change. And I think we've seen that with the NMP review, where you get the, well, yes, some people have raised the importance of timely access, but of course others have said, we also need to focus on value as well. And value is one of those words that instantly seeks to undermine the merit of timely access. And I think and even now, if the pandemic has taught us anything, is that we should be very cautious about modelling, because but we are, when it comes to medicines access and when it comes to healthcare in Australia, we are sort of all at the mercy of the modellers.
We are.
I think it's right for us to all have a cast a pretty cynical eye over that, particularly when the driver is so driven by this want to achieve value, which when government says that, we all know what they're talking about, was that we don't want to spend the money.
Yeah.
And so the language to me is really important.
The language is so important. But again, I think the way that we depersonalize that process at that funding level, at a political level, within the bureaucracy, the way that we depersonalize by necessity, right? Oh, no, but we must remove the human factors here to a point because we need to make sensible economic decisions and we need to make, you know, whole of population decisions and we need to make future-proof decisions and we need to do all of those sorts of things. And that's all very well when we've got the benefit of some detachment from the experience. But when you do that at the top of the system, at the pointy end of decision-making up there, then the flow-on impact to a patient down here in the weeds where we all are is that style of thinking, that model of thinking is very much permissible and that has a very, that detachment, that sort of being sort of unaware of or not committed to the human story and the personal experience kind of gets legitimacy when we kind of make decisions this way about our system and then we support that down here for a patient when we do a multidisciplinary team meeting, for example, where we make decisions in a hospital context, in a clinical context, again, with no input and participation from a patient. And I don't understand why we do that. I mean, this system is here, this entire system has been generated and created to benefit the patient. That's why it's here, that's what its purpose is, that's what we're doing here. And I can think of no other industry where we treat people like university case studies, where we, you know, depersonalize to the extreme insofar as we don't even, you know, allow a patient to come in and be an active participant in their clinical experience, you know, and to be an active participant in the decisions that will get made about their own care. And if you just look at that, if you remove these assumptions that that's the way that it's always been done and has to be done, and actually just look at it as objectively as possible and think, how is it possible that we make these decisions without even having a patient in the room about their own treatment? How can that actually be a thing? But we've done it the whole way through. We do it in all parts of the system and it's legitimized every time we do. And I can tell you when you're a patient at the end of that decision-making chain and that culture of decision-making where we've depersonalized the patient the whole way through and not even ignored their voice, but not even acknowledged they had one, then that's a really scary, lonely place to be. And then we talk about how important it is to have patients as an active participant in their healthcare and how much better the outcomes can be when we involve the patient in their healthcare, create ownership for their own bodies, but we haven't acknowledged and designed an opportunity for them to do that at any part of the system whatsoever.
That approach surely will become less acceptable. And so 20 years ago, a particular sort of language would have been used. And now that language has changed and it's described in a different way. But it's all protective of that kind of decision making. And I just can't imagine that in the years ahead there isn't going to be far more scrutiny of how decisions are made for patients, the sort of attitudes that guides those decisions and patient involvement in them.
Yeah, I really hope so. I think that, you know, language is so, so important. And I know that many advocates have conversations about the role of the sort of pivot away from the use of patient as a term, for example, and why we must pivot to the use of the word consumer, because that depicts a more active and aware and educated and maybe, you know, literate participant in the process because they're a consumer. And of course, the problem that I have with that pivot of language and what we've done there is we've basically acknowledged that we have created a minority experience for the patient and taken away all of their power and really given them really no say at all in what in what they do. And so instead of acknowledging that and saying, well, that's actually where we need to make the change, we need to completely change the patient experience so that they actually do have power and they actually are a participant and we actually do value their opinion. And rather than create an alternative identity and hope that people are educated enough and have access enough and have sufficient competency and financial access and whatever else it is that necessitated or required to enable them to pivot to become a consumer, because that's what they should be, because then they're empowered. And that's wrong. You know, they are a patient. They need healthcare. That's why they're here. That's why they're in the system. And they would really, frankly, rather not be a patient. And each one of us is going to relate to that over the course of our life at one point or another. You are a patient and you need care, and that's why you're there. You don't need to be known and interpreted as any other empowered entity in this discussion. We don't need that. We just need to talk about the fact that you're a patient. Until you're better, you'd rather not be. But while you're here, how do we make this as great an experience as possible, which includes, of course, access to the ultimate outcome of getting better and not being a patient anymore?
Yeah, I don't think anyone's wildly enthusiastic about being a patient. But that's the reality of our lives, and it's an experience that you're currently living. And we've spoken many times during the year, and I've been shocked by some of the things you've said to me, and it's made me reflect on language a lot and how language is deployed. I mean, 20 years ago when we first started seeing the early signs of incremental innovation and in personalized medicines, and you would have therapies that would extend life by 3 to 4 months, the sort of language that was used by some decision makers was, well, yeah, but that's going to cost $20,000 just for a few extra months of life. I said, well, exactly. Exactly.
It's a bargain, really.
It's like, hello, but I think the system realized that sort of language wasn't going to fly. That people did want the system to respond positively to that sort of innovation.
Yeah.
And so now then the language became one around value. We have to ensure we get value. And so now we have a situation where the system spends an awful amount of time thinking about the economics of a treatment rather than the impact on a patient, on the individual patient. And so it takes your experience as a patient and clumps it in with thousands of others and decides that, well, what we're going to try and do is create this patient suit for this product, and we'll sort of average out the outcome, and that's where we'll land, and we'll take 1 or 2 years doing that. And I'm sorry, that's me, it's just not good enough. And I don't think we shouldn't have and it's, to me, it's not even contentious to suggest that it's not good enough, is that we don't want the patient broken down to the vagaries of an economic model. But unfortunately, that's where we're at. And I think Ian Noble from Amgen said to me last week, he said, Paul, health technology assessment and the modelling that is associated with that should be an enabler. It shouldn't be a hurdle. And I thought that was a really nice characterisation of the issue, but we're spending an inordinate amount of time speaking about these technical processes without taking a step back and just going, well, what are we trying to do for patients here? What are we trying to do? And let's ask them. Rather than locking them out of the discussion,
what's the outcome?
What's the outcome?
That's right.
What they want.
What's the outcome? And I think that, if I could characterise, I'm a stage 4 cancer patient, right? And so, for me to be, next March is my 5-year anniversary of my diagnosis. So that's a massive milestone for me on paper, because to continue to be alive 5 years post-diagnosis as a stage 4 cancer patient, statistically, according to the model, is significant. But for me personally, being alive 6 months after that diagnosis or 6 years after that diagnosis has a massive impact to myself, my family, my loved ones, and the impact that I might, my little human mark on the world, right? My opportunity to do something significant with my life. And that understanding of what that value of a human life is and what they can contribute whilst also being sick is just dramatically misunderstood. To the extreme. I think that this understanding of, if you're a cancer patient, well, that equates to you being a net drain on the system, on the economy, on society, on all of us in general, that characterization of the patient experience is so wrong. That's so misinformed. But it's a product of the fact that there is no human connection and there has been no understanding of what patients actually do other than patients. You know, we do other things, you know. Mm. We have other parts of our lives that we're running over here whilst we're also doing that access to the medicines and the healthcare. So, yeah, that conversation and characterization of the HTA process as yes, an enabling step that's actually informed by all of the relevant inputs, and it's not informed by that patient, that human experience of what it actually is to be treated by these drugs at all. There is just no input for that at all. And so it would seem to be a sort of a decision-making process that's missing a few critical inputs, I would have thought, my experience.
Yeah, so you are a mother, you know, you are a business person, you know, with a fantastic business. You're a patient advocate. Oh, and you happen to be a patient as well. And I don't think it should be too difficult for the system to actually look at you as a whole and involve you in a decision about what's right for you and your family and loved ones when it comes to your treatment and your engagement with the health system. Now, people say, oh, well, you know, it's very hard to do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. And that's why you got to do it. I think it is easy to do it the way we currently do it. You know, that's much easier to do it. We just stick a bunch of processes together to justify saying no to things and to create a scientific basis for it or some economic basis for it. But the system has to be better than that. And I don't think it's it should be in any way contentious for us to acknowledge it. It's going to be a tough thing to construct that sort of system, but doesn't mean it's not worth doing, and in fact it is. Yep. And I think that's why you're such a powerful advocate, because you bring in all your professional experiences and your personal experiences into what you do. And I'm really looking forward to having recording another podcast with you in March to celebrate that 5-year anniversary.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, it's a massive moment, I'm so acutely aware that I'm here because I'm educated, because I've got the money to spend and the arguments to make, and you know, I can walk in and sit in front of doctors and make a case for why I shouldn't. You know, if we had followed the path that has been modelled, that has been written up, that has been costed and funded accordingly, for me, if we had followed that path, I'd be dead by now. And this has to be, you know, said that bluntly and acknowledged that you know, openly, that the system as it is standing now did not want me, did not create a pathway for me to live. And so every decision that has been made has really been contrary and counter to system recommendations. So, you know, system says at this juncture we should turn left, and we've turned right every single time, and I'm still alive. And so for me, you know, then there just becomes an impetus to say, well, that's great for me, but what about everyone else? What about everyone who can't articulate their case as clearly as I can, who didn't have access to, you know, that series of private specialists who wanted to do something really radical, who, you know, who were a little bit older, who didn't get told, well, you know, Nicole, in this case, okay, look, we're going to do this because you've got a young son, or you know, because you're so passionate, because you work so hard, because, you know, like, those things shouldn't be a prerequisite. You shouldn't have to be, you know, in your 30s with a family in order to get, you know, great healthcare and for people to step outside, you know, the predetermined decision-making pathway. And so I just, you know, I guess I always want to reiterate that the commitment to change is definitely there. You know, the energy and the enthusiasm to review and to reform and to improve and to give patients access and to do what we need to do is definitely there. And it's just about the execution of that now. You know, how do we really do that? How do we really shoot for the stars? How do we, you know, make every decision that we're making for patients just be the one that carries us, you know, closer and closer to that outcome of just being the highest standard of care available for that individual in that system. I think if we're all always trying to operate with those parameters in mind, then we will only continue to do good. So I just want to, I guess I always want to wrap up with some kind of uplifting and positive, because I don't want to be sitting here sort of giving everyone a hard time and giving the system a hard time, because I've certainly benefited from every component of our health system in an absolute way myself. And so let's just make sure everyone has that opportunity is, I guess, the energy and the message that I want to make sure I include.
Nicole, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that and for being so open in your experiences and bringing your professional expertise to your experience as a patient and then building on that with that advocacy. It's incredibly powerful, and it's what your willingness to share your story, including on social media. People should definitely follow you on Instagram, because you do some fantastic posts. Nicole, thank you so much. I really do look forward to chatting with you in the new year, and I also just want to thank you again for being so open and sharing your experiences and your perspective and your thoughts with us today. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Thank you, Paul. Thanks.